are people going to see that nothing ain't never gonna change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight. Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
And today we are having another roundtable. We have Travis and Rachel from Irreverent Testimony with us and Tom from the Coffee Cast. Welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks. Hello, everyone.
Hey there.
So we wanted to start the top of the show by talking about the difference between strategy and tactics and how Democrats should be moving forward. Will and I have been talking, as you have, Travis and Rachel, about Indivisible. And we had the people from Flippable on the show, and they were amazing. So there are these huge protests and all this stuff, all this action is happening. But should we be taking aim like a laser, or should we be firing like wide, like a shotgun? And while grassroots activists are working tactically and being actually successful in many ways, who should be managing the strategy, or should the strategy be managed at all?
I think trying to manage the strategy of this energy and uprising the left is tantamount to herding cats at best, yeah. I would say. So I think for the time being, because, you know, one thing that the Tea Party had, their focus was pretty narrow. We hate that there's a black guy in the White House, and let's just obstruct him at every turn.
Right.
Whereas from our side, there's a million different priorities and interests, and now there's a big purity contest thing that's, I mean, it's, but right now it's kind of galvanizing. Like, I think a good example would be at the Women's March that we went to a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. There were signs and chants from all kinds of different interests. It was about immigration. It was about reproductive rights. It was about, there was some stuff about trade. It was about economic equality, and everybody. And, you know, we were all sort of looking around going, yeah, that, yeah. And I'm into that. And, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
So I think the idea of sort of just casting a wide net to get everybody excited and focused. And like, I think a good example we're watching right now today, there's more protests and marches everywhere that are very much focused exclusively on the whole travel ban and the immigration policies. So these things might just sort of regiment themselves naturally.
I feel like for me, it's good that we have a wide net and that we're talking about a lot of issues, but my primary focus at the moment is the fate of the Republic, is really talking about the constitutional crisis that is looming and whether or not. So rather than, I guess, focus specifically on like reproductive rights or LGBT rights or the things that I typically am passionate about right now, I'm primarily concerned that the Republic may or may not stand with this man. And so sort of, I think the strategy needs to be to oppose him at every step, but also keep an eye on the big picture of, is he going to work within the rule of law or not?
Well, we already know he isn't because he's in breach of the Emoluments Clause.
Right.
Okay. And to your point, Rachel, I think that we have so many scattershot options because he's scattershot and he's all over the place. He rules by chaos. And he rules by fear, and he rules by cruelty. And I think they definitely took a page out of and understood Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine.
I'm actually reading that right now.
Yeah, exactly, you know, what they're doing. And I think that the thing to do is, it may come down to the Justice Department. It may be come down to that arm protecting us, as I read this morning, from some of these crazy edicts that he's been throwing out. For us, I think that on the ground, I think as long as we show opposition and as long as we respond to our representatives as strongly as possible, I think that's our first step. But to let everybody know that at least we have the comfort of each other for right now, is the best that we can do until at least two years from now. Go ahead, Arlo.
I have an amazing story about current action and success. I contacted my Senator Donnelly. I also contacted Senator Young, but he's a mess. I contacted Joe Donnelly, who is a very conservative Democrat, and his office got back to me. And I had wanted to set up a phone call with him to talk to him about NAFTA and how that specifically affects my company and jobs that will be lost if Trump crashes NAFTA. And Hoosier jobs here in Indiana. So I wanted to be able to give Senator Donnelly a specific story he could tell to his colleagues, he could talk about on the floor, about a little company in Indiana that's an exporter. And his scheduler was happy to set that up, but she said she couldn't do it as a phone call because the phones keep crashing and they can't even make calls out. So wow. She said, it's so bad. The Senate is receiving so many more calls than it has capacity to receive every day that senators cannot count on having outgoing lines. So he would rather set up a meeting in person. So I have an in-person meeting scheduled with him.
Wow.
Awesome.
That's amazing.
So can you give us a little background on what exactly you will be arguing, sort of the minutiae of it? Because I'm a geek about that stuff.
Okay, so my company export 80% of what we build. And right. Canada is a significant trading partner for us. And if we have to go through the process of and the cost of the duty that we don't have now, in addition to the exchange rate, basically deficit that Canada is in with the U.S., then it puts a great deal of pressure on my Canadian dealers. So it makes my product less competitive against other foreign goods. Because, of course, I have foreign competitors. So if I can't ship at a competitive price into Canada, I will lose that business, and that will cost me jobs.
Okay.
Right. So this idea of tariffs on everything, it's like either Trump didn't think it through, or he's too stupid, or his constituents are too stupid to realize that what happens in a trade war when you try to slap tariffs and that happens in reverse. And all of a sudden, all the exporters get screwed, and how that can completely spiral the economy and make the trade deficit exponentially worse.
Well, the economic problem we keep seeing is it's a focus on supply side. Republicans keep focusing on the supply side and not the demand side.
They'll never stop.
They don't understand that we need to focus on having customers, and we can choose between having, 400 million customers in the United States or 7 billion customers worldwide for American goods and services.
Well, the other thing is I just did it, 10 seconds ago, but we always talk about jobs and trade in the same breath. And as this economy moves forward, we do need to realize that jobs and trade are not the same thing. And we need to have other strategies for the Rust Belt jobs that will never, ever come back.
Because of automation, right?
That's right. The jobs that went to Mexico would have gone to China if they hadn't gone to Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, but they certainly wouldn't have stayed here. Under no conditions would they have stayed here. We actually have more jobs because they went to Mexico. In other words, right now, goods ship back and forth and back and forth and back and forth across the Mexican border, and companies on different sides do different aspects of, for instance, airbags or seatbelt assemblies and those kinds of things for auto manufacturers. If that's not possible anymore because Mexico isn't close enough, because the border is closed and there's a 20% tariff there, then American manufacturers will just move the whole thing to Vietnam.
Sure. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. Now, here's my hypothesis on this and where we might ironically get bailed out of this potential disaster by the big corporations. I think what's happening behind the scenes is that they're sitting back. They're not making a lot of public proclamations. They know that Trump's backers have a lot of energy right now. But behind the scenes, they're pushing. They're talking to the Congress people that they know and they've already greased, and saying, you better step up to this. So I think the big war that's coming is not so much going to be between us progressives and everybody who resists Trump. It's when Trump, I mean, he can issue all the executive orders he wants. Ultimately, though, these things are going to have to go through Congress. And I don't think Paul Ryan and Congress are going to go along with this crazy tariff business that he wants to do. And I think the war that's coming is actually between Trump and congressional Republicans, especially on trade. What do you guys think?
If indeed they get that far, I just wanted to jump into that point.
Yeah, go ahead.
The damage within. And the point is that you've got a White House that is completely disorganized, and you've got everybody inside who doesn't even have a clue. So we've got somebody who shoots from the lip, who's at the very top. And what's happening is that they are so unstable and unable to focus on one thing. They're jumping from one subject to another. Whatever comes out is a sort of a half-baked plan or proclamation. And what happens is by the time they start dealing with the process, the people who are engaged in the process, like Congress, are largely confused by what comes out of this White House and Trump. So to me, I think that what will happen is this will take more time. This will slow everything down. And as we all know, the moment you begin to lose momentum and you get farther and farther from that first year and a half in office, the less and less and less political power you have. You already are underwater on a popular front. But I'm thinking that everything is just by its own confusion. It's going to be they're just going to trip themselves up. Well,
I'm not convinced he's going to get a year and a half in.
I was going to say, how far, that was my next question. How far does everybody think he's going to get?
Well, to build on that point real quick and then move on to that question, because one of the main points I wanted to get to about that is he's making enemies of factions that we would not have considered possible to pull into the Democratic framework or to pull into our supporters ever. For example, the entire defense industry. Look at the F-35 program he's talked about canceling. That involves the United States defense industry and the defense industries of Turkey, the United Kingdom, Germany, and every other member of NATO. They're all working together in some way on the F-35 project. If we get involved in a trade war in the middle of the F-35 project, that scuppers the whole thing. So there's that aspect of it. There's everyone else that has a business in the United States. So the entire U.S. business community, the Chamber of Frigging Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, those guys are going to be enemies of the Trump administration if he messes with trade. We're looking at a situation where all of the left-wing and right-wing power systems in this country are going to look at this guy and try to bring him down, which leads directly into what the next question was, which is how long does he have? And I mean, I don't want to start predicting the downfall of Trump because we've been doing that for months and months and months, and he got elected. And so I don't want to predict anything now because obviously my powers of prediction are not what I thought they were. But at the same time, there are opportunities for us to fight this president. There are opportunities for us to find allies we wouldn't have considered to be allies before. And that allows us, similarly to the way that it allowed the Tea Party to push our agenda at the same time and to work for a better country that is more progressive, that has a better economy for everyone, that actually sees investment in rural areas and in infrastructure that we've been talking about for a long time but have never been able to do, that actually achieves a number of things. And so I personally would like to see however long Trump lasts for us to use this as an organizing effort to kind of get our message to places as people start to be hurt by him.
I think that things are starting to get cumulative fast, much faster than I predicted. And it is because Will's right. There's the defense industry, but then there's tech who can't get their workers back in the country. And then there are farmers who this whole immigration thing is going to screw up royally. And
These people have lobbyists.
Yes, these people have very, very expensive, you know, lobbyists who are very good at what they do. And it is amazing to me to be on the same side of any battle with them. But, you know, you take your friends where you can find them.
This era makes for strange bedfellows, that's for sure.
Well, and we get to go to those folks and say, hey, you may not like some of the taxes we want to put in. You may not care about some of the things that we're going to do to protect those farmers and to protect those workers. But at least if you put Democrats in power, you're going to have them.
You're not going to blow up.
Well, that may be the new paradigm going forward. If, you know, every future candidate may just ride this line of pseudo populism, anti-trade, you know, whatever, and then maybe they will come back to us, and that could have a negative impact. But we're getting kind of ahead of ourselves. But it is an interesting point, Arliss.
Well, what I'm trying to ask really is, do you think on top of everything I've just mentioned, that Trump's threats to China about war in the South China Sea, I think that whether we heard about it or not, whether anybody talked about it or not on, you know, Meet the Press or anyplace else, I think that Republicans turned around and went, what the hell? Because
this is a bad thing, Aunt Arliss.
This is a world war.
Yeah, this is a Kelly and Bannon kind of thing. This is where
can I set the stage real quick for this? Because there's a point that I think needs to be made about China that is not made enough about China. Deng is the guy who led China towards its current status of engagement with the world and, you know, soft-ish capitalism and markets and stuff like that.
Right.
He was one of the guys that he was supporting modernization. And the situation in Tiananmen Square was a reaction to his policies. The students were supporting his allies. And the government's response, the sort of party's response to the whole situation set him back and set his modernization attempts back. It's a really interesting story, a really interesting history. But since Deng, and even before Deng, but definitely since Deng, China has operated on the basis of rational self-interest. They're not erratic like the Russians. They don't have political conflicts with other countries where they're going to, you know, go after a U.S. interest just to go after it. They're not going to behave in anything other than a really rational way, which is to act in whatever happens to be their interests. And that has proven, again, since Deng, to be something that we can actually work with. We spent a long time trying to make the Chinese into someone who isn't an adversary. Which is why we've been saying that the Russians are the geopolitical foe and not saying that about the Chinese, because every time the Russians have asked the Chinese to back them on some, you know, plot against the United States, the Chinese have said, nah, you do you, Russia, but we're not interested. That doesn't benefit us at all. Why would we fight a war with a trade partner?
Exactly.
We had been working so hard for generations on stabilizing that relationship, on guaranteeing peace in the Pacific. I'm working very hard when China does do something like try to claim the entire South China Sea as its own. That this kind of destabilizing action, again, remember Tiananmen Square, remember the tanks getting sent in, remember the hardliners. There are still nationalist hardliners in China. And Trump's action disempowers the rational self-interest types in China and empowers the radical hardliners. This is incredibly dangerous. What he is doing. Because by the time we are able to wrest the executive branch away from this guy, we might find that the Chinese have had their control wrested from them by their own hardliners. And we might find that the China we have to deal with is a place that is more interested in taking destabilizing actions. This is incredibly dangerous. China was not an adversary, but Trump's doing everything he can to make them into one. And that is terrifying.
And sure it is. And I completely agree. the point I'm, it's fear. When you have something that is a frenemy or somebody you've been trying to deal with that is like China or Russia, when you introduce fear, I've come to understand for Russia, a lot of their geopolitical actions are based upon fear. Fear because they have an economy the size of Italy, because they have, terrible fear of what the United States is doing with NATO. I'm not putting down NATO at all. We've attempted to try to stabilize Europe and Asia, but the introduction of that into their mind is what motivates them toward these negative consequences that you speak of.
Well, and the Russians come by their paranoia honestly. The great Russian plane has left them open to invasion after invasion after invasion after invasion. I mean, if you go way back in Russia's history, somebody was always freaking invading Russia from everywhere. The Mongols, everybody from everywhere. So that they are paranoid, it's not something they just, stumbled across one day in the dark. They earned it the hard way. And
right.
If we treat them as anything other than what they have evolved into, we are denying history. And of course, Trump has no understanding of history. So, there's that.
Well, it's the introduction of chaos into the body politic, the introduction of chaos into the international realm. Look what's happened over the last 8 years is Obama has come in and just soothed the irritation and the horror of what has happened with what we did in Iraq and elsewhere throughout the world because of W. And we've gotten to a place where the things are like they're not perfect, they're not perfectly balanced, but they are at least smooth and settled down. How the hell can you screw up a relationship with Australia? I'll just throw that out.
That it requires skill. That's, I mean, not just anybody can do that. That is a skilled screw up. I mean, a joke David Waldman told that I just loved was that congratulations to anyone who had Mexico and Australia in the office pool for World War III.
Right.
And who thought that the Germans would get to save the world from fascism at the end of the third act? That's the plot twist I wasn't expecting.
That's kind of a neat storyline there, yeah, potentially.
Explaining the Geneva Convention? Explaining the Geneva Convention to Trump? Are you kidding me?
Yep.
At what point? Hello?
And then the Japanese and Italians can join in just to make it,
poetic. Yeah, I really do think that this season of Black Mirror sucks. I'm not enjoying it at all.
But yeah, we feel the same way.
At least
it got Americanized. It's just not the same.
At least we have, that level of narrative. I appreciate the authors taking us in that direction, but still.
Yes.
Well, when you hear somebody like Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the EU, talking about, if we can't rely on the United States is our primary trading partner, then we will look to China.
Sure.
Makes sense. Of course they will. And, honestly, companies have to be, big companies, have to be absolutely white knuckling this last 2 weeks. And they will be the guys, these corporations that we are forever protesting against, I swear, they are very, very likely to be the guys who, lean on their bought and paid for representatives enough to solve this problem, to get us to Pence.
Yes.
Whenever you have this kind of instability in corporations, like, people going out at Google and Apple and just going out and protesting and petitioning at where you would actually have a servile workforce. This is new. This is totally unknown. I mean, like I said, the United States has led a stability about the world. And now that stability is now ruptured, ripped, when you've got the EU that is beginning to identify the United States as an unreliable, unstable, potentially hostile force. That's huge. That's trouble.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to start being called a regime, I think, by countries.
Yeah, I see where you're going.
It's all terrifying. I mean, we have to get to Pence. And I never thought I would say that sentence out loud. But I think we have to get to Pence. We have to, I can fight him on the issues, and I will. But at least he's a person I think that will work within the confines of our government and our constitution and the rule of law.
I'm not so sure about that, but at least he's not a Russian agent.
He's not right. Insane. I live in his state.
He's mentally ill. Trump is mentally ill. Whatever criticism you may give of me for saying that, his behavior is that of a mentally ill individual.
Oh, yeah. Yes. There's no doubt about it.
Yes.
And whatever is happening beyond the erratic part is that you've got two other people who are deeply damaged. Yeah, they're calling the shots, Stephen Bannon and also Eric Prince, who is also part of the remote part of the family, who
Blackwater
ran
guy.
Blackwater and then Z or Zoo or Zai or Zuzu, whatever the hell it is, that they're mercenary army.
General Zod.
Kneel before Zod.
Well, they've managed to run Secret Service officers out of the White House. I mean, they've fired Secret Service managers. I don't know if you all caught that news at the very end.
I did. I know the Secret Service was having all kinds of problems even under Obama. The Secret Service was a little out of control. But
well, the thing is, like, that terrifies me because the last thing I want is for there to be an assassination attempt or even something successful against Trump. I want our institutions to bring this man down.
Yeah.
I want all these checks and balances that my family and everyone else in this country has spent the past 400 years building. I want those institutions to be strong enough and powerful enough to take this guy down. That's
what I want.
Well, security's
already deeply compromised. I heard on NPR yesterday, he's still using an older model Android phone to send out all his tweets. And the consensus is it's likely already been hacked and likely already been turned into a listening device by who knows what foreign agencies or interests or God knows what.
No question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found a new talking point. I was getting ready to call Senator Todd Young's office. And so I was thinking about what would be effective to lean on somebody like Todd Young. So when I got his person on the phone, I said that I understood that as a Democrat, Senator Young and I were going to disagree on almost everything. But here's what we could agree on. He was a Marine. And he served this country honorably. And I know for sure that Senator Young does not want to see us at war with either China or Iran. He does not want to see us in wars in those theaters.
Yes.
I would hope that would be the same for a lot of our elected representatives.
Yes, but I also said to him, you know Mike Pence personally. You know he is an honorable man. And I said that with my fingers crossed, but you have to consider your audience. I said, you know, Mike Pence, he's an honorable man and he's mentally healthy.
Yeah.
That's also arguable, but yes.
Well, yes, my fingers were crossed.
As compared to the other guy. Yes.
The scale has changed, folks. So I said, Mike Pence. Mike Pence will not endanger our country in these ways. Please make sure Senator Young knows that these are my concerns. And the guy on the phone said, yeah, we're hearing you.
Was it Chad or Jeff? Because we've determined every staffer, Republican staffer, is named Chad or Jeff.
Yeah, that's what I call them. Jeff, Chad, Jeff.
Chad,
I can't,
Jeff.
They change so often. I call our representative, Cory Gardner, our senator, I should say.
Piece of work.
And, I don't know if you guys saw this in the news. It made national news. He's getting so many phone calls and so many people that he's decided first he was dodging them. So he would run away,
literally
go out the back door, get in a car and leave his office. Then he turned his phones off. Then he disabled his voicemail. Bill, that made national news. So now he's meeting with people and answering the phones. But he's decided to say that all of us are paid protesters because he saw an ad on Craigslist. And so we're either paid protesters from outside of the state of Colorado or paid protesters from inside the state if we happen to have a local area code. But there's no possible way that actual citizens, are that many of them, are calling him and coming to his office, that they could possibly be that upset. That's the new thing.
Have you heard the thing about the flat senator?
No.
Did one of them get run over?
No. People who are having exactly that problem, they're having life-size photo reproductions made of their senator, and they're posing with him and doing this, basically it's like, flat, so yours would be flat Corey. Or flat gardener, and they're staging all these hilarious kinds of protests and putting it up all over Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and absolutely terrorizing these guys with flat antics.
That's hilarious. I will look that up.
Just to embarrass and humiliate them. I think we're at the point where humiliation is almost as valuable as actual. Rational protest.
I can't tell if he legitimately, if he's in that much denial that he really does think like, there's no way I won the election. Like, there's no way that there's that many people that are mad at me. Or if he just knows that he's going to roll over and do whatever Trump tells him.
Well, he aligned with Trump pretty early in the campaign.
Yeah.
Right?
But I mean, I can't tell if he's in denial or if he just knows that he's going to do whatever Trump says. And so he's trying to make excuses. But he's getting a lot of pressure in Colorado. Like, we're blue all over. So it's very disappointing that he's our senator. But, he's getting a ridiculous amount of pressure from the state. I don't know that it'll make any difference. But
Yeah, Rachel, I mean, remember from Indivisible, the idea that these people like very much to be thought of well. And when people show up at their offices, and there are a lot of them, and they're phones are flooded, and there's a lot of negativity. A lot of negativity gets into their, let's just say their social or their news stream. That that starts to affect them, and they start relating to that. It's the unreality that the Republicans, the world that they live in. That if it's not just the Fox world, that Republicans and whatever infosphere that they're in, but the idea that the really true believers and the scary ones at the very, very top, the InfoWars, the Fox News is, the drudge, that they, the world that they only listen to, this is the reason why you get the kind of product that comes out of them. Therefore, of course, they wouldn't believe anything like that because they've been told all along beautiful, wonderful things about them and reality. Make that reality much more harsh. Make it painful. Make them pay. Yes. Never let up.
Right. I call him every day. Every day. I call Jeff or Chad and I tell them what I want to bitch about today. So do many of my friends. It's been kind of amazing to see the activism from people that I know that previously have sort of been apolitical or like, I vote in elections, but that's pretty much all I got. To see the level of activism that has sort of risen up in my community has been extraordinary.
And that's why Gardner is so shocked.
Exactly. Yeah.
I wish I had a senator to bother. I really do.
Aww,
yeah.
Here's your monthly reminder that people in the District of Columbia have taxation without representation, pay the same taxes everybody else does, slightly more actually because of the cost of living, but we don't have congressmen or representatives.
Well, you know what? And because they all vote Democrat, that's why they'll never give a statehood like they do with Puerto Rico. But the idea is that terrifies me the most is the mentality of the White House currently. If we get some kind of natural disaster in the terms of an enormous earthquake or something else, I'm sure there would be a huge gap delay between any activity, any action, any help at all coming out to the West Coast in any kind of way. They go, oh, they're all blue. They didn't vote for us. Screw them. I'm sure that they would take this kind of Katrina approach to whatever thinking. There's no level, no end to the cruelty and the division that they want to put out. That's not paranoia. I'm just thinking standing in their terrifying shoes and thinking how they would probably think.
Well, I agree. I also think that there's a larger point about any kind of natural disaster or terrorist attack or major national event. What I'm afraid of is the state of exception, right? There was this political theory class that I took when I was in college, and there's a book called The State of Exception, and it explains in detail sort of how governments use an emergency powers thing. Like, everyone's familiar that Hitler did it, but this is a very common tactic. You take a natural disaster or a terrorist attack or...
The Patriot Act, for instance?
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you make an exception to the Constitution, essentially. You say, we are going to stand outside of the rule of law, but only because it's an emergency and we have to, and it's for your own good. And that's something that I've been really concerned about. I've gone back to that book and trying to get through it because it's really plausible. And you basically just use people's fear and anxiety and the chaos around whatever the event is, and you make the government no longer have to abide by the rule of law. And it's always supposed to be temporary, and it never is.
Yep. So, speaking of not abiding by the rule of law exactly, Trump has already filed as a candidate for the 2020 election. He did it 5 days after he was inaugurated.
Yeah, Jesus, I saw that.
Christ. Yeah.
Okay.
But here's the problem with that. It functions as a gag order on not-for-profits, because if you are a not-for-profit, you cannot participate in a political campaign. So for not-for-profits to speak out, they have to be able to speak directly about the President Trump, and not about candidate Trump. They have to be able to parse this line, to walk this very, very careful line, and it opens them up to lawsuits left and right. It is a gag order. That's the purpose of doing... I mean, he can also accept money for his 2020 campaign, which is why he's doing it. He wants to rake in the bucks, but it also functions as a gag order. If you think it's chilling, if you think what he's doing to media is chilling, that is terrifying.
Wow. Okay.
Merry Christmas.
Yep.
Sorry, let's...
And the other thing I wanted to touch on was that a 2020 census is constitutionally required, but a thorough one is not.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't say that the census doesn't say how hard you have to work to count everybody, right? So Democrats, much more difficult to count. No one anywhere has said this yet, but if you cut the budget for the census and we aren't paying attention to that, that is an absolutely deadly weapon against us. And
well, when you say we, I mean, the media is not going to pay attention to it. It's not sexy. No. It's not interesting. You know, Chris Saliz is not going to tweet about it. But yes, we are going to have to make a lot of noise about that and flood Chad and Jeff with calls and emails yet again.
And it's why a house in 2018 is so important.
Right. No, it's vitally important. So just for the cheap seats, if anybody doesn't connecting the dots. If we do a bad job of the census and we don't count a whole bunch of Democrats, the census determines the districting of our House and also how many representatives each state gets. That's the sort of political point of the census, right? Yeah. So if we just don't count a bunch of people, that's chilling. Yeah. Wow.
Well, what are we going to do? I mean, I think that as long as we stay vigilant and make it a big deal. I mean, I know that there was some obstruction and some difficulty in the last one, but that was only because there were dead enders that wouldn't respond to it.
Well, there was a bunch of psychotic hyperbole that the census was FEMA troops that were going to take the guns or something.
You don't get to know this information about me and blah. Yeah.
The answer is to win the state houses. The answer is to win those state houses, because after the census, even after a crappy census, there's still redistricting that's going to happen. Right. And if we control that process, I mean, let me pull up the map real quick, because I was just looking at it. It's a ton of Republican governorships are up for re-election in 2018. If we can organize in the local level, and in some blue states like Maine or bluish states like Maine, we can take out those Republicans and we can replace them with Democrats, and we can run the state houses and run the redistricting process, which gives us Congress back in 2020. That's what we got to do. And yes. As much as I would love for us to exist in a world where, as liberals, we have to stand up for, you know, fair play and all that, we keep falling for it. So, you know what? Let's do gerrymandering back. I'm sorry. We see what happens when we don't gerrymander. We see what happens when we do things the wrong way. We get this Republican Party and this government. Let's guarantee a permanent Democratic majority and take these guys out and start playing hardball for once. And then once we have that power, we actually provide services to the American people, prove the government works, and then end this discussion about whether or not we ought to have a federal government by proving to people that there's one that can be effective and that they can trust.
100%
I think you're so right. I think that people who have come into the process over the last year, you were brought in by the promise of what Bernie, you know, had said, and the empowerment of his message, to me, is something that I think that people should just step up and start running for these offices that we need. We need people in the mayorship. We need people at the county level. We need people on water boards. We need people, because this has been something that Republicans have been doing with impunity over the last 30 years, is that they have gotten and dug themselves in deeper than a tick in all of these state houses. We take it back when we start ourselves taking these positions back. And we have to start in the unglamorous, yet very important positions that are throughout our states, throughout our communities. And it's about time. And with that inspiration of what I see, so many people coming in, now is the time. And this is the energy that we need to take it back with.
Well, and let's be clear, Tom, those people running for office need to be millennials.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, that we need to be supporting
yes.
not only the grassroots, but the younger grassroots, so that they can grow into higher office.
Yes.
And we can build the machine that way. We can build the overall community that way. And I think we ought to give serious thought to not asking older people to run for office unless we can't find somebody. I think we really ought to work hard to find millennials for seats.
And, you know, we are deeply involved in our local politics here in Colorado. I'm a part of the Jefferson County Democratic Party, but also the Jeffco Young Dems. And that's been one of our focuses, is how do we infiltrate the Democratic Party in the state of Colorado? It is run by and kind of lorded over by old white people. And they sort of think of us as like, oh, isn't that cute? You showed up. But we're not taken seriously. And so the Jeffco Young Dems, one of the things we talk about is like, how do we make it understood that we're here, we're serious, we are going to push you and this party to the left, and we are going to push it toward progress, and we're not willing to sit back and like, we're taking it away from you, essentially. You know,
that's
like,
right. That's what I was just
we're taking
say.
It away. Yeah. It's not yours anymore. And if we get enough of us, we can do that. But there is definitely pushback for I've been doing this for 30 years and these are all my friends and we run everything. And it's like, well, I don't care. You're running it terribly. So.
Yeah. Well, but I think the thing is that you have to be successful, you're going to have to take it back and then reach back and invite them forward.
Yes.
In other words, it can't be you or me. It has to be all of us together. But
yes.
It needs to be millennials who are running for office.
Yes. Agreed.
It happened here in Clackamas County in Oregon starting mid-year, when more and more people hearing Bernie's message turned out for Democratic County meetings. And what happened was the leadership actually turned over. Now, of course, there are older people that do run the county. Nevertheless, though, that they're far much more attuned to what's happening. And everybody who is coming, the meetings have doubled in size. The energy is there. There are more and more people, much more energy, much younger number of people coming, and they are being empowered. They're being empowered, and my point of view is give everybody the keys. Give them the keys. Go. You're the energy. This is what we need to do. And then what we do at the same time is we go, there is no scorched earth between the establishment, the status quo, and the new energy. I don't care. We got to make it work. So therefore, understand that we're in the same boat together. And that's kind of what's happening here in this particular place. I've seen it happen. It's pretty dramatic.
That's amazing.
We got to kick out the scorched earthers on both sides, because there are going to be the... let's just use Hillbots and Bernie Bros for this. They're going to be the old Hillbots who thinks that anybody who voted for Bernie Sanders is evil and awful and needs to be kicked out of the party. And you're going to have the Bernie bots who think that anybody who supported Hillary Clinton is evil and awful and needs to be kicked out of the party. You have those two lunatic fringes, and then the vast, vast, vast majority of Bernie and Hillary folks are like, we have more important things to worry about than the really awful election we just had. We have got to move forward. We've got to work together. We've got to actually get these things we worked so hard for. We had the most progressive platform in history. We need to build on that rather than abandoning it. We got to take that stuff forward. And I think the vast majority of Democrats recognize that. But we have these dead enders on both sides that are arguing the other side needs to get purged. And really, they're the ones who need to get kicked out.
Yeah.
Because I know tons of, well, you guys were for Bernie. You guys were for Bernie in the primaries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We caucused for him.
Yeah. So Earth Glass and Blue Gal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were the, our show were the Clinton folks. Like, we came down on the Clinton side of things because, you know, our politics and all that. So, like, we have that in our podcasting universe here.
Sure. But the big difference was we never talked ill of Hillary Clinton.
I love that woman. I love her to death. It was the most difficult decision I've ever made politically, to caucus for Bernie.
And then, yeah, once it was clear Hillary was going to be the nominee, we were just as enthusiastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. But
because we're all Democrats.
Right. God damn. So
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Gosh
exactly
darn
right.
Right.
Gosh darn
Rachel.
Right. Yes, we are all Democrats. Yes.
And so what that means is that we need to take a page out of what the Tea Party did, which is candidate recruitment. Back during Occupy, the Democratic Party showed up to Occupy events and to things like that and just kind of wandered around lost. The Tea Party showed up to right-wing protests, looked for people who were charismatic, and were like, you, we're running you as a candidate. Here's a bunch of money. We got some fundraisers to back you. Here are the things that you're going to need to compromise on, but we'll get you an office, a position, and then you can fight us on those things down the road. We just need to get you a seat. And we need
campaign
to...
campaign in a box, as David mm-hmm. describes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Democratic Party didn't do that. The Democratic Party shows up to where candidate recruitment is and says, can you fundraise? And then when we have a party full of wishy-washy sycophants, we wonder how we got here. It's because we have a party of fundraisers, not a party of fighters. And that's what needs to change. And if our local Democratic parties are not going to actually recruit those fighters, we need to do it ourselves and kick out these, you know, seat warmers who've been running things.
Well, that's what's happening. I just read something this morning that something in the past 2 weeks, something like 3,300 people have signed up for some sort of candidacy for the Democratic Party. And granted, a lot of that is a wave of energy, and half of them will flame out or not be able to raise any money or get any traction. But still, that's a pretty impressive number right there.
Also, Will, having worked on a local campaign, I can tell you you're exactly right. You're exactly right about the fundraising. That's what they care about. That's how you win. That's the primary focus is door knocking and fundraising. And I think you're right that people who aren't effective at fundraising do not succeed in the Democratic Party. And maybe we should take a page out of the Tea Party book and take that off the table.
Well, we don't have the luxury of Coke money.
Yeah.
So
it's true.
That.
We don't.
And or Adelson money.
Well,
the money to fight terrible, terrible campaigns against us.
Like I have pointed out, we are going to potentially have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the defense industry, and a bunch of other folks on our back. And the thing about the defense industry is they don't care if we use the weapons. They just care that we buy them.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, folks. How much money did the ACLU raise last weekend?
Oh my 24 God. Million, right?
Yeah, in 2 days over the internet without asking for a dime. They just, you know, the Trump's order hit and people poured money into the ACLU more than they have ever raised in a single year ever for under any conditions.
Yes, which is
so
amazing.
Money isn't the problem we used to think it was.
And Bernie proved that. Bernie proved that.
That's
absolutely
true.
So do any of you listen to Pod Save America? The guys who used to be on Keeping It 1600 now have, they've moved over to Pod Save America.
Okay. No, I didn't know.
Yes, go to Pod Save America. It's great. So this last podcast, they had the mayor of South Bend, Indiana on, and he is running for DNC chair. And he was talking about why, you know, obviously he's talking about why he's running. And he's saying that it's because he thinks that we need to change from a federal perspective at the DNC to a local perspective, to supporting, you know, to driving local races, state races, you know, those kinds of things. And we solve our problems federally if we solve our problems on the state level.
Right on.
And he was really, it's a great podcast. I really encourage everybody to go over and listen to the Keeping It 1600, where they had actually two different candidates for DNC chair. And it was well worth your time and energy.
Okay, done.
Yeah. Check mark.
Definitely gonna
I'm on
check.
It.
Tom, what do you see as the biggest changes between the time when you and I were young protesters and now?
Those times.
More kids on your lawn, I bet.
Well, if I were that age. I think that the level of... I think the thing that strikes me is always that politics was like the thing of like older people. You know, I always see like a lot of... You know, especially where like we were watching The Crown last night. And it was just like, we just like looked at each other. My wife and I looked at each other. And they just kind of like, it's just like old people, old white people just running shit. It's always like the way it used to be. And over time, you know, we always would get this, you know, kind of approach that, oh, and the young are coming in. Hey, the young are taking over. It's the whole new, you know, kind of whole new world. And it's just like, goddamn right. It's about time, because it's the only thing that's going to save anything. And, you know, young thinking is the only thing. The status quo is what I have absolutely no interest in whatsoever. I'm not interested in how things were done. Whatever the hell does that mean? So to me, I think I see a greater engagement and I see a much more compelling reason. Nobody had a compelling reason to get involved. You talk about politics to somebody and just, oh, I don't want to talk about that. You know, it's too ugly. Well, excuse me, but that's like how stuff gets done. That's how footprints get put on the moon. That's how women are able to get the vote. That's how we're able to like do amazing, incredible things, because that's where stuff actually happens. But now it's nearly a life or death kind of situation where people are like wide awake and they realize that no matter what age that you're in, that if you're an older person, if you have children, grandchildren, or whatever, if you are a person who is young and you're terrified about the future, for one particular reason in time, you are compelled to act. So to me, I that's what I see clearly as the zeitgeist of this moment, that we're this nexus between a chaotic, authoritarian, fascist type of approach, disruption of everything that we know, and yet at the same time we see individuals that are compelled. People, men and women, must step forward and they must act. They must be compelled to do this. I know that, you know, I'm going on about this, but I find that at this moment that we are at this particular point in time, this is what is happening, and this is what we are called to do. And so I hope that from this moment that I see is new in politics, is that people are compelled, they are called their call to action. They're called by their conscience, by their their sense of I'm actually drawing a blank here. You know, their patriotism, the fact that they think about the love of the, of their children, or the love of their fellow human being.
Freedom.
To me, I think that's where we are. Yes, that that this is important and vital to them. So to me, that's where I see it at.
Anybody else? Rachel, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree. I think when we talk about generations and we talk about young people getting involved, it seems to me that every generation gets more liberal than the last, or more progressive, or whatever you want to say. I look at the young women that are just a generation below me. Maybe they're still even in our generation. I don't know. But, you know, teenage girls who are so fierce. They're fiercer than I am. And they're challenging things like, you know, there's a 14-year-old girl who wore some kind of shirt to school that was against the dress code.
Yeah.
Because boys might see her collarbones, and they are standing up for themselves. They are fiercely feminist. More so, I just think every generation gets a little more liberal than the last one, or more progressive. And I'm so proud of them. And I look at them, and they're more intersectional. They're more aware. It provides me a lot of hope, and I'm proud of them. And I will never. I don't like the idea that, you know, older generations sort of criticize the younger generations. I see a lot of hope in these young women in particular, and a lot of the young men. You know, even there was a protest on a college campus where it was beginning of the school year, and there was these fraternities that had these disgusting messages on like banners outside of the rooms, like, drop your daughters off here, that kind of nonsense. And a bunch of young men who were freshmen came out and stood in front of the fraternity with signs protesting those other young men. I just think, you know,
yeah,
it's just, yeah, it gives me a lot of hope.
Well, your generation gives me a lot of hope. So,
well, thanks.
I want to thank all three of you for joining us here today on Hopping Mad. It was a wonderful conversation, and
our pleasure.
It really encourages me to talk to folks who are fighting, basically. Yeah. The one thing I'll tell our listeners is that we will not have a new Hopping Mad for at least this coming week and the following week, because I am having surgery. In fact, as you listen to this, if you listen to this on Monday morning before David's show, I will actually be in surgery at that very moment. We will be back as soon as we can. We just don't know how quickly I will recover. So think good thoughts in that regard. Will and I both send our thoughts out to the team at Netroots Radio, and especially to all of you for joining us here today on Hopping Mad. You can find the broadcast version of our show on Netroots Radio Mondays at 8 a.m. The podcast version, which usually includes Extra Mad, which is the extended part of the interview, is always available on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, MyTuner, TuneIn, and Overcast, our website. I'm hoppingmad.com, and you can listen to or download the show there. We welcome your comments, thoughts, tweets, and suggestions, either through the website or via Twitter at I'm Hopping Mad. Will is on Twitter at WillMcLeod99, and I'm there, of course, as at Arliss Bunny. Next up is K-Grow in the Morning, here on Netroots Radio.